Hello, everyone, and welcome to minute 53 of season 8 of Movie Room Minute, the Daily Podcast, where we foobar our way through the 1998 Steven Spielberg award winning film Saving Private Ryan, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining once again today on the first day of 2025, so Happy New Year, everyone, is Aaron Neuwirth from Out Now with Aaron and Abe. Welcome back and welcome to the new year, Aaron.
Tom Hanks, you for having me.
Ooh. And your Vin Diesel welcome. I don't know. how do you respond to that? I don't know.
you smile politely. That's how you do.
That's right. And that's what I did. And whatever. But you couldn't. But no one can see that I'm smiling politely. So
you can. Yeah, that's part of the problem. You just have to feel it.
Did you feel it?
Oh yeah, I never feel it. I always feel it.
Oh, okay, all right, that's good. It's good that you feel it. So minute 53 begins with Caparzo trying to lift himself up on the piano, and ends with Caparzo trying to get some reassurance from those around him. So we ended things yesterday with on a note of Caparzo falling on a piano after getting shot. And everyone quickly reacts, trying to figure out what's going on. What do they need to do? How are they going to stop this? You know, where did the shot come from? Oh, well, you know, everything goes through both our mind and the characters' minds, you know, during this these few seconds. You know, the shot rings out, we see the blood splatter, and then, you know, I remember, you know, wondering what's going on here. Also, you know, because it comes as quite a shock the way that the whole thing plays out, which is done really well. You know, they're able to, like, when you're going through the idea of what it is that's going on here, so you eventually can figure out, you know, the plan of Spielberg with this whole thing. But when you're just looking at it from the perspective of these characters, it does come as a surprise. It was one of those, I guess, inevitable surprises from that perspective, because, you know, they had the whole argument yesterday about whether it's a good idea or not a good idea, and you know nothing good was coming out of it. But you don't know specifically what would happen. You know, I think Spielberg missed the opportunity here of actually shooting one of the other characters and not having Caparzo be the one who gets shot.
I mean, that comes down to, I mean, for one thing, that feels like a cheat versus subtlety or lack thereof. And Spielberg, for all his talents, he knows how to make things. He does express certain kind of themes or what have you without like budging over the head with them. At the same time, he's also one that wants to really hit you with the truth sometimes. And the fact that you do have a character that's very specifically trying to do something that he shouldn't be and putting himself into a situation he shouldn't by just standing out in the open, distracting everybody. Everybody's distracted at that point. I don't know if I would buy a sniper randomly shooting the guys that are behind cover versus the guy that's making the problem.
Right. No, I understand from that perspective. I'm just saying it makes it seem as if you know, we're now punishing.
Well, you're asking for shock value for the sake of shock value at that point, as opposed to the thing happened because he made it happen.
Right.
He put himself.
Correct. He put himself in that position.
The other guys, they didn't get shot because they're behind cover. They're not in that scenario. They would, it, like, if you just shoot them because that would be more shocking, you accomplish that, but there's no meaning to it. It's just randomly getting shot. And I get, you can argue, well, that's war, but it's like, well, no, there wouldn't be a logic to why that would happen to begin with, because they're literally behind cover.
Right. But I'm looking at some perspective that if it would have been more effective if the, you know, Caparzo's actions led to someone else being in danger, not just himself. You know, that's what it comes down to. Because, I mean, one of the things we discussed yesterday was is that he's you know, by taking the little girl, he's endangering everybody. He's not just endangering Caparzo. So, yes, it makes sense that Caparzo is going to get shot because he's the one who is not following orders. And therefore, when you don't follow orders, people die. You know, that's what it comes down to. That's the Jack Nicholson, perspective on it. We follow orders or people die.
I hear what you're saying as far as you could make him be a function that gets somebody else killed. But now you're adding guilt to a character that is not going to be defined because he's one of the soldiers in the back as opposed to one of our main characters. It adds a wrinkle. It adds unnecessary wrinkles that don't necessarily go anywhere beyond. We just have to like not like this character now because the movie wanted us to not like this character. It's too much. It's too much to add to an already.
Right. Okay. I see that also. I mean, again, I'm not complaining. I'm not complaining about what
and you're telling you yourself are telling
for sure.
I hear you. If you're pointing out what we could have done, I'm saying okay, these are the repercussions of what you do if that's the change that you make. And you're already saying him getting shot to begin with was already surprising to you. The point of what the scene's doing is there. I mean, so adding more trouble on top of that, you know, that's putting a hat on a hat. It's like, all right, that's now not only am I surprised by somebody getting shot, but I have to like, now I have to say Vin Diesel's the whole time too. It's like, I don't want to say Vin Diesel's that's not helpful to me. You know, Alpha Boo's already in it. Burns is already, this is too many ass. I'm creating more.
I can see that point also. Right. Again, I'm not knocking what Spielberg did here. I think it's perfect.
I'm not saying I don't present this as a way to like be combative. I'm just I'm looking at this logically as far as right. Okay, let's say okay. That happens.
All right, no, again, it's still effective in showing us that I see as the result of that. Trying to care for this family of civilians is detrimental and dangerous. That's what it comes down to. And okay, the guy who actually did it has you know, Caparzo has lost his bearings. He doesn't realize where he is. Because if he realized where he is, he would have made sure to stay in cover also. But this whole scenario has changed him to the point where he's like, okay, well, you know, I'm caring more for this little girl than for myself. And then, you know, he sort of gets discombobulated and keeps himself out in the open. You know, so, okay, I can see it from that perspective also. Parzo tries to find a way to steady himself on this broken piano, and in the end just, isn't able to do so and just falls into the middle of this square.
Which feels like in case you didn't get it already, he's been shot and he's dying. Like, that's what it's kind of adding to that. It's like, by the way, guys, like, this is what happened here. This guy is not functioning anymore. That's right. That's a few extra seconds that we're getting with that.
That's right, because he walks in the other direction. Also, he doesn't even try and walk to cover. He walks him more into the open space.
Yeah, I mean, what,
like where one, can I go to be more of a target?
For one, the bullets like that's already propelled him in a direction, and he's lost all of his bearings at that point. So it's like I don't know what to do. I'm just trying to do something, and it didn't work.
No, didn't work at all, unfortunately. And then he just falls in the middle of the square. And he sort of convulses a little bit also.
Yeah.
And then we get a shot of Jackson, who is trying to figure out what's going on, and he grabs Upham and takes Upham to safety. Now, which you got to give Jackson a little bit of credit for that. You know, that he knows that Upham isn't going to know what to do in this situation. So here, I'm gonna keep you safe. You know, which is somewhat ironic because later in the movie, the whole idea is that they have to keep Ryan safe. You know, from the same type of idea, even though Ryan has been trained. And again, many weeks from now, we'll talk about the fact of, Ryan sitting there crying as everything's going on around him in the middle of the battle. But that's the emotions of battle, I guess. From that perspective. And, at this point, we get to see that Jackson is an expert in this type of stuff. He immediately says he was on the ground before we heard the shot. And you know, he's he's the group sniper, so obviously he knows what's going on about this whole thing.
Yeah, he's got his senses over
there. Right. And then the
wheels are immediately turning for him. He's looking around. He sees what's going on. He's just like piecing all this together.
That's right. And then he looks around and tries to figure out where is the best location to have made the shot. And then he points up to like a bell tower and goes, "That's where I'd be."
It's a good reveal on Spielberg's hand, and I mean, on Kaczynski's hand, like Kaminsky's hand too. Like, because up until this point, we don't know that tower's there. Like, the film is very deliberately not showing us that there's a stray clock tower, you know, out in the distance. So by the time you watch, you have Jackson's perspective, and the camera's kind of moving around. It moves in a way so it reveals that there's this tower, and it's like, oh yeah, there we are. And
exactly.
It gives us the firsthand expression of him realizing, oh yeah, that's where that makes sense.
That's right. And then he says, "I didn't see it." And he says, 450 yards, Captain. Maybe a shade under." Then he turns to the rest of the men and goes, "I wouldn't venture out there, fellas. This sniper's got talent."
It's a good line. I like Barry Pepper. I'm a fan of him as an actor. I like him in this movie. I think a lot of people like him in this movie. It certainly helped him get more roles. When you work with Spielberg, he tends to do that. Look at Vin Diesel. I like the idea that he's this religious character and that he uses that as a way to help him. The one thing that gets me is this accent is a lot. Like, I get that he's supposed to be like a farm, you know, a boy from the South and whatnot. But it's like, okay. I know what Barry Pepper sounds like, and he's laying it on a little thick in this one.
That's true. He is. Now, do you know Jackson's the character of Jackson, what his first name is? You have any idea?
Daniel Jackson, right?
That's right, Daniel Jackson. And in the novelization, they expand slightly on it, and his name is Daniel Boone Jackson.
Okay.
And he's apparently supposed to be 23. Which means he's one of the older of the men in the squad, according to the novelization. Who do you think of the squad? Not including Miller. Miller is older than everyone else, and so is Horvath. But of the main characters, who do you think is potentially supposed to be the oldest?
At that point, I guess Ed Burns, Ryben.
Okay, Ryben is actually Mellish is the youngest, followed by Ryben. Followed by Caparzo, followed by Jackson. And according to the novelization, at least, the oldest is Wade, which doesn't make any sense whatsoever. I think Wade is supposed to be like 28.
Yeah.
You know,
Ribisi is baby faced for life. So, no,
that's right.
That's not the translation that you take from that novel.
No, I wouldn't take that
screen.
No, not at all. Not at all. So I mean, according to the novelization, he's from a town called Hickory Valley, Tennessee.
Yeah, that tracks.
Which was a town that was incorporated in 1820. What do you think the population of this town is according to the 2020 census?
Real quick, Edward Burns is the oldest of these actors. Just point that out. So in my mind, it made sense to me that he would be the oldest.
Yes, I would agree with
what's
that.
What's this town?
Hickory Valley.
This town, Hickory Valley, Tennessee.
Yes.
In that year in like World War II times.
No, I'm talking about today. I don't know what it was.
Today.
Today.
Today, Hickory Valley, you know, a good 456 people.
There are currently 78 people who live in the town of Hickory Valley.
All right. I think it's going to be like 2,000. I'm like, all right, never mind.
No.
Jesus.
And what's interesting is in the 2010 census, so a decade earlier, there were 99. So there are 21 people who left Hickory Valley between 2010 and 2020.
Uh-huh. Read books.
It apparently has 3/10 of a square miles. It's a very small town. But hey, it's apparently where Jackson is from.
Okay.
Actually, if you go back to the census of 2000, there are 136 people. So something was going on that people are quickly leaving. Yeah, I don't know. don't know why. And at this point, you know, Jackson is trying to figure out what's going on here and how he's going to stop this sniper. And then we hear the French family crying and screaming to their daughter to, you know, in French. And we actually get to hear the girl's name. Where did you hear what her name was?
No.
It's Jacqueline. Jacqueline. Which is just the female version of the name Jacob. Or Jacques, if you want to use the French. Now, it was a name that wasn't very popular until the 1960s, when it became much more popular as a female first name, obviously because of Jackie Kennedy. And
there's like Jacqueline Bisset and other actors, yeah, and whatnot. But yeah, obviously,
right.
Yeah, Jackie Kennedy.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, for sure. There's a whole bunch of people named Jackie. I'm not I'm just saying it wasn't as popular until the 60s.
No, not a battle. I'm just acknowledging, you know, there's like actors at that time.
Yes.
And stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Jacqueline Bisset. Of course. And so, you know, the girl starts crying also. And then we see Upham like stroking her hair. You know, none of these guys were really known for anything beforehand, which is again why Spielberg chose almost all of them, you know, for that very reason. Let's choose people who are not going to distract us. You know, watching the movie, you know, 26 years later, actually now it's 2025, 27 years later, is, you know, you say, wow, all these guys are so famous. It's more distracting watching it now than it probably was when it first came out from that perspective. But it also makes it easier to know who's what, who's who and who's doing what, you know, from that perspective. And then Mike turns to the little girl and says, please don't cry. I'm going to take you back to your mom and papa. Please don't cry. Come on. And, you know, Miller is completely no nonsense here. And, you know, he knows that Jackson's going to go try and take out the sniper. And, you know, Jackson then walks behind the car to try to get around it. And if you look on, he walks past or whatever it is, there's a number of signs on the building. So the first one that you can see, it says AVIS, AVIS. Do you know what that means in English? AVIS, AVIS. I mean, obviously, it's supposed to be French.
No.
So it's a piece of advice or an opinion, things like that. So it looks to me that there's like someone has left an opinion piece, you know, on the wall. You know, so it's an editorial, I guess you can say. And then as Jackson moves a little more, you see another sign. And the only word that I was able to make out of it is blackout. So the, you know, it could be that this is a call to people, you know, that, you know, during all the bombings and stuff like that, you know, it's best to turn off all your lights and make sure that nobody will, bother you. You know, that nobody, you know, that when the bombers are going by, they're not going to, you know, bomb the village because they're not going to see any lights and stuff like that. But we'll never know. Because you can't really read what it says. I found like a whole bunch of different interpretations of the word blackout. Do you know any others besides when you deal with it in wartime?
Just the term blackout?
Yeah.
Outside of war? I mean, like going so unconscious that you just forget your nights. This is my main understanding of blackout.
Okay, that's one of them. So, I mean, you have power outage, you know, loss of electric power.
Yeah.
Blackout, right?
Yeah.
Broadcasting is if there's a ban on the broadcasting of an event, that's considered a blackout also. You know, you have like years ago, I used to have an account on MLB that I was able to watch baseball games, and you have the whole blackout events, stuff like that, certain of where you live and stuff like that. So, you know, that works that way also. A fabric known as a blackout material that will block out. Then you have, you know, censorship, which is media blackouts. And then you have what you were referring to. You have a blackout, which is, it could be a drug-related amnesia, a loss of memory because of medicine or alcohol. Then someone could just have a blackout or loss of time, which is a form of amnesia, which you can have it. You have free diving blackout, which is a loss of consciousness caused by cerebral hypoxia when you're in a on a deep dive type of thing. And it's also known as which is a culture bound syndrome for that type of thing. So, you know, One little word with lots of meanings. And at this point, you know, then Jackson is trying to find a good place to hide. And, you know, we get a shot from the other side of Caparzel. And we see, you know, more or less from his perspective, where Miller and the others are all hiding behind this car. And then we see that he's looking over at Jackson, and Jackson puts his finger up to his mouth and, you know, basically says, shush, type of thing. Which I think is great, the way that they show this. Miller then says, Carpi. And then Caparzo turns back and goes, Captain. You know, he's completely helpless, and he's trying to basically lift himself up, but... just can't do it. You know, and then we see Jackson rush off to the side, you know, trying to find some cover. And then we get a 2-second shot of Mellish. Did you notice what Mellish is doing here?
Is he crying again?
No. He's taking like bricks and trying to hide himself.
That's what, you know, it is. Like, yeah, okay.
He's like moving the bricks so that...
it's, you know, Mellish doing that?
It's Mellish doing that, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's at the 58-second mark, you can see that he's doing it. And it's great. Because also, the shot is great because the shot is from behind Caparzo's head. So Caparzo is blurred, but we see Mellish, who, you know, is basically just trying to hide himself, give himself a little bit of cover here, you know, in this apparently very dangerous situation that they're in.
You know, another,
I like the way that they do it.
Yeah. Another, honestly, just good thing about the way this is being structured and why it, like, makes sense to me, that you have Vin Diesel here, who, yes, not the Vin Diesel that we know now, but he's certainly, of this crew, he's one that looks fairly formidable. He's Vin Diesel. He's a fairly big guy. He has a deep voice. He's got a specific kind of attitude. You kind of figure... You know, Ed Burns at this time is about as popular as Tom Sizemore. Like, you know, they're like, these are guys that are kind of safe that you're not expecting to be worrying about. So you're looking at Vin Diesel. He's the toughest guy in this crew by default outside of, you know, Sizemore and Hanks. And it's like, oh, yeah, he's the one that ends up being, you know, the most compassionate, the one that wants to look after the child. And then it's the one that gets shot. It's the one that gets taken out. Right. He's the one that, you know, between, you know, there's. You know, Adam Goldberg and Giovanni Ribisi are, you know, they're fairly slight by comparison.
Yeah.
They're not big guys. And Vin Diesel's the one that gets knocked down. Okay. And then you have this whole sequence here where he's just, you know, it's agonizing because there's nothing they can do about it.
Right. Yeah. We'll see a little more of that tomorrow when we get to it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we get a shot of Miller just like looking around and, you know, knowing that there's nothing that he can do to help Caparzo until Jackson deals with the situation, I guess, you know, from that perspective.
Yeah. You don't want to sacrifice more men for this. You need to figure out what how to solve the right. issue.
But Caparzo is sort of trying to seek some sort of assurance or reassurance from the, you know, from the men around him, including Miller, that he's going to be okay, type of thing. You know, that that they got him. He's fine. You know, that type of thing. But we'll have to see what happens with that. You know, from that perspective. So that's all I have to say about this minute. Did you have anything else you wanted to add?
No.
Okay, great. So every Wednesday, we have a segment called World War II Wednesday, where my guests will give their top five World War II movies. So, Aaron, once again, why don't you start with your number five and work your way up?
All right. Well, for this list, I wanted to avoid Holocaust movies specifically. I wanted to focus on movies that are pretty much set in World War II and without that aspect of it being main topic, just to give myself some different kinds of options. I also wanted to keep it, like, again, in the war specifically, something like Casablanca I left out because it's not really a war movie necessarily. It just happens to be set during the war. And then I also left out things that we've covered. So, like, there's no Saving Private Ryan because we're doing it. Great Escape's not on here. Stalag 17's not on here. And Band of Brothers is like an honorable mention because it's not a movie, but, you know, it's worth pointing out. So what that leaves me with, these movies that I already just really like anyway, but it's just trying to give myself some qualifiers. Yes. First up is The Thin Red Line, the other 1998 World War II epic from Terrence Malick, who came back from his very long vacation and decided to make another movie. This movie is fantastic. it's Terrence Malick doing his thing and doing it very effectively. It's got an all-star cast, which makes No Nevermind, because it's like there's so many like big stars and bit roles and others that shine in their parts or what have you, and it has such a unique perspective. Speaking of scores from earlier this week, it's got a terrific Hans Zimmer score in this movie that's just absolutely fantastic. And it's Terrence Malick, so it's, you know, one of the more beautiful movies you can watch. Number four, I have Black Book, Paul Verhoeven's World War II spy German drama. This movie's rules. It's like seeing Paul Verhoeven at this point, he's going back to Germany after, you know, his stint in America, where he had several great movies. And then he's, you know, now he's like doing like what he was already doing back when he was working in Europe. But he's got a good size. It's like a huge budget movie, but like it has a certain sense of scale, and it's just this wonderful film with Carice Van Houten giving this terrific lead performance. It's very, very good. If you haven't seen Black Book, I certainly recommend it.
Yeah, I liked it. I also liked the bookends, the way they did that movie.
Yeah, and I haven't seen that since it came out at this point, but I still have vivid memories of aspects of it for sure. I look forward to I think I own it. I should really like watch it at some point. Let's see. The Best Years of Our Lives, William Wyler's epic World War II kind of PTSD type film. It's dealing with these kind of servicemen after the fact, after they've come back from war. I mean, you've got a number of great stars here from the 40s, Frederick Marx, Dan Andrews, Teresa Wright's in here. There's a lot of great people in here, and it's William Wyler who's doing his thing. Really strong storytelling. It's William Wyler. He knows what he's doing as far as making movies. Spielberg took notes. Next, I have. I mean, this is how do you even rank this? But like Inglourious Bastards. I'm a huge Tarantino guy, and I'm not one that really likes to say best film versus favorite film because I just don't really think there's much of a difference there. But I tend to think that Inglourious Basterds, I would say, is his best film as a director. I think, like, as far as everything he's doing, I think this is, in a career that has a lot of fantastic movies, I feel like this is the best that he got. While Jackie Brown is my favorite Tarantino movie. Whatever the case, Inglourious Basterds, I think, is a spectacular film. The way he handicaps himself as far as removing the pop culture aspects of what he's been able to incorporate into his film and just focus instead on a film like this, which still has many of his other themes that he constantly uses in his movies. And then, you know, use it as an excuse to make this kind of history bending tale that's full of origin of life characters and all the just fun stuff that Tarantino can do, in addition to being incredibly tense and introducing much of the rest of the world to Christoph Waltz. It's a fantastic movie. And then number one, I have Bridge on the River Kwai, which rules.
No.
I don't know how much I really need to say about the Bridge on the River Kwai, except for the fact that it's just one of the greatest films ever made. But it is. it's a fantastic film. You have this great performance from Alec Guinness, William Holden, and Jack Hawkins, like David Lean doing his thing here. So many memorable things about this movie. The way you see the interactions between like Guinness and his team versus the Japanese and what they're putting them through. Once you get like past the first act, that's largely Alec Guinness being in solitary and like let him like really let loose on like, here's what you've all been doing wrong. This is what we're gonna do right now. There's just a lot of like fun to have with this. It's such a, we're talking about Saving Private Ryan, which is a film that really changed how war movies were made at that point. Like you have distinct periods of war films. Apocalypse Now was obviously one that shifted a lot of things as well. Bridge on the River Kwai in that old school version where it's all about the patriotism of America and what have you, and showing things about like going hardcore on it because you're not really doing that in the 50s. But that's such an exciting film to watch for a film about POWs. It's so much fun to like watch this movie play out and see the different things taking place and whatnot. So yeah, Bridge on the River Kwai rules. That's a great movie.
So in other words, if I choose to use that as a movie in the future, you will definitely partake once again.
That's an easy one for me to say yes to. Sure.
Well, it's high on my list. So it hopefully will come about at some point. That is the plan. Even though I don't have a plan right now, that's what it comes down to. It's part of the plan, how's that? All right, thank you very much for that list. So Aaron, why don't you once again tell people where they can find Aaron Neuwirth?
Everything that I do can be found on my personal Substack page, dakotazeek.substack.com. I write film reviews for We Live Entertainment. I host a podcast with my friend Abe called Out Now with Aaron and Abe. I write Blu-ray and Criterion reviews for whysoblue.com, and I'm on all the socials at Aaron's PS4.
All right, and finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on website, movierobminute.com. You can send me an email to movierobminute@movierob.net. You can find me on Twitter, you can find me on Instagram, and you can find me on Facebook. So, until tomorrow, earn this.
Earn this. Solitude. You